Prepare yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did ya? I say there ain't nobody. I say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow. Now is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast with host Eddie Trunk.
Hey folks, it's Eddie Trunk, and welcome to another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. New every Thursday. Anywhere you get your podcast, thank you for subscribing, and thank you for listening wherever and whenever you do it. It is greatly appreciated. Bringing you great news-making rock interviews each and every week with your favorite rock artist. Be sure to check out some of the older episodes if you missed anything. And again, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss anything. And you can always connect with me on social media at Eddie Trunk, Twitter, Instagram, fan page on Facebook. And, of course, eddietrunk.com is the website. Got a lot of good stuff going on. We've got a lot of things happening and ramping up as we start to close out the summer, believe it or not. It's amazing. We are, like, you know, on the verge of Labor Day, the unofficial end of summer. And still some shows happening, some shows going away, tours happening, some tours being canceled, kind of all over the map here, as has been the case as we continue to battle all this COVID stuff. Hopefully things are cool by you and everybody out there is doing well and staying safe. We've got Rocklahoma coming up Labor Day weekend. I'm looking forward to being back out to host that. So you don't want to miss that. If you are in the Tulsa area or headed that way, look forward to seeing you for Rocklahoma. 2 years in the making, more than 2 years in the making since we had it last time. So that's going to be a fun one and a big time party for sure. Other cool stuff coming up, including in October, greatly looking forward to being out at Monsters on the Mountain, which is happening in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. And of course, 80s in the Sand sold out in Cancun at the end of the month of October. Keep an eye on my social media. I'll keep you updated on everything going on. Don't forget, I'm also on Cameo. If you're interested in a personalized video, you can find it, my profile, just go to cameo.com. for more information on that. So this week, two interviews for you. These all originate, as I tell you each and every time, on my Sirius XM radio show, Trunk Nation, which you can hear on Volume, which is channel 106, live Monday through Friday, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time, nightly re-airs, 10 to midnight Eastern, anything you want, anytime you want on the Sirius XM app. If you're only listening to the podcast, you are getting a tiny fraction of what I do on a daily basis on the radio. So please be sure to join me on Volume 106, Monday through Friday, live 2 Eastern, and that replay every night, 10 Eastern for your convenience. Full shows, interviews, and more anytime you want on the app. Also want to send a special message out here to my friend Lanny Cordola. Lanny is a tremendous musician who for the last, 7-8 years or so, has been living in Afghanistan and educating kids through music and helping kids in that war-torn country. Well, needless to say, if you've been following the news, things have never been worse in Afghanistan. And this past Monday, Lanny sent out an appeal to anyone who can help him. This is a release from Lanny Cordola that I want to share with you that's important. It says, for the last 6 years, the Miraculous Love Kids, a nonprofit organization established by musician Lanny Cordola, has served as Afghanistan's only school of music specifically for war-torn, poverty-stricken girls and young women. The current circumstances in Afghanistan have placed the organization and its members in an extremely difficult position, prompting an appeal to the world for assistance. The following statement details the group's dire situation and a plea for help. It says, quote, today our lives are in great danger as the successes we achieved in becoming part of Afghanistan's cultural scene has now marked us for persecution and even death by the Taliban. What began in 2015 with three girls has grown to nearly 200 students learning music, as well as basic reading, math, and life skills, all funded entirely by grassroots donations. We've recorded music with Brian Wilson, Tom Morello, Sammy Hagar, Nick Cave, Blake Shelton, and more. Now, with the Taliban's rapid takeover of Kabul, we are literally in hiding, with our most senior students in particular danger. Our school is closed, and many of the people who are supposed to protect us now see us as a bargaining chip to gain favor or even a bounty from the Taliban. As girls playing Western music with our American male teacher, Lanny Cordola, we could not be at greater risk. This article goes on basically just asking for anyone to help, anyone that can make donations, anyone that can provide government assistance to these people to get out of Afghanistan. This is horrific and tragic what has happened in Afghanistan. Lanny is a fantastic guy who has spent 6 years of his life helping these kids, and to see what they are dealing with is stunning, heartbreaking, staggering. If you'd like to learn, help Lanny and learn more about his mission and helping these kids, go to the website miraculouslovekids.org. Again, that's miraculouslovekids.org. If you can help in any way, please do so. He's a wonderful guy. This is a wonderful initiative. And now, as that country has completely crumbled, they are in grave danger. MiraculousLoveKids.org. I wanted to put that out there for Lanny. All right, let's get to our interviews this week. And this week on the podcast, I'm going to bring you two. We'll start with Joey Allen of Warrant. Joey, in this interview, which was done on the day of the 10th anniversary of Janie Lane's death, talks about Janie, how difficult it was for Warrant to try to help Janie when he was battling with his sobriety, what they went through, stories about how Warrant was formed and Janie's role in that, how the songs were written, and of course, what Warrant is doing now. Joey Allen up first on this week's podcast from Warrant. I think you're going to really enjoy these insights and these memories of Janie, which again, this interview, as all my interviews originate on the radio show, this aired live on what was the 10th anniversary of Janie Lane's death. Interview number two, which aired a couple weeks ago on my volume show, is with Jack Blades of Night Ranger. Jack talks about the new album, some of their upcoming appearances, and also the never-ending question, will Damn Yankees ever play again? Great stuff from Jack Blades. You'll enjoy that as well. Here is Joey Allen of Warrant, interview number one on this week's podcast. Joey, thanks for a few minutes. How you doing, man?
I'm good, Eddie. How are you, buddy?
Good, good. You know, it's always great seeing you out there on the road. We had a chance to hang at Sweetwater recently, and I've seen you guys so much. It's always fun when you're on the same shows, we're on the same places. The band is just killing. But, you know, it just floored me that it's been 10 years since Janie passed today already. Pretty remarkable that much time has gone by. At least it feels that way to me. I imagine you as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not a good day to remember, to be honest with you. And, you know, it's been a long while. It doesn't seem like it's been that long. So, you know, it's just not a good day to remember. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Joey, because being an East Coast guy, I don't really know the origins of this, but when did you first meet Janie? I know Janie was from Ohio, but how did you guys first connect, and what were the seeds of you and him and Warrant coming together? Because I'd read some stuff about it. I guess he was there doing a different band and the band's kind of morphed. Can you take me through that?
Sure. Steven and him were in a band called Plain Jane, and then there was Warrant, and Jerry and Eric were in Warrant with a different singer, drummer, and lead guitar player. And almost during the same week, Plain Jane, the band Janie and Steven were in, their bass player and I think guitar player decided to do something else, or either that or Janie and Steven decided to do something else. And at the same time, the drummer, lead guitar player, and singer, and Warrant left to go do their own thing. So it was kind of like both bands were looking for somebody. I think Jerry and Eric, that's the first guy they thought of, Janie and Steven, because they knew they were free. And they went and put a letter on where he was living and said, hey, man, we're looking for a singer and a drummer. What do you guys think? They still had Josh in the band, which was the first lead guitar player, in Warrant. So those guys got together. They played around for about 6 or 7 months, and then Janie wanted a different lead guitar player. I had been in a band prior to all of this with Eric down in Orange County called Nightmare 2, a little heavier than Warrant. And I met up with Eric literally on the Sunset Strip across from Gilter's liquor store. And he said they were looking for a guitar player. And, you know, I went and met Janie at Eric's apartment. I remember meeting him one night when he was getting ready to go out to have fun or flyer or whatever. And he was with Becca Bramlett, who was his girlfriend at the time. And we just introduced each other, said hi. It was nice and went on. And then I jammed with him a few weeks later and got in the band. So that's the abbreviated version.
What were your impressions of him early on, you know, just meeting him like that? Were there any concerns about him and issues with drinking or anything like that? Were there flags? Was he kind of thought of as a guy that partied too much that early on, or did that not come into play till later?
No, I mean, first of all, I saw them live before I met him. So I saw them live in a backyard, so I saw him perform, and I'm like, wow, the guy's got chops as a singer. Kind of reminded me a little bit of Brad Delp from Boston, because he had that full range and it was super clear. It wasn't a gritty voice. And you know, I didn't really hang out with him until I auditioned for them. And oddly enough, you know, after I auditioned, while they were making their decision, I told them I said, anybody want a beer? It was on a Monday night, and I ran and got a 12 pack. And, you know, we were all in our 20s. So we were young and just really super ambitious. And I never really saw anything prior to, I mean, we all had a good time, Eddie, during the Dirty Rotten tour, Cherry Pie tour, Dog Eat Dog tour. But during the Dog Eat Dog tour, generally when he started going through his first divorce, I started seeing, you know, a darker side, you know, and I don't want to point fingers at all, because he's not here to defend. You know, we all had our vices at the time. But that's when I first really saw a darker side of the partying go down.
That's interesting. So you didn't really feel it and see it as a flag beyond, again, the 80s and the excesses of the 80s. Everybody had a good time. We all know that. But you didn't really see it become a concerning thing until about 3-4 albums in with Warrant then.
Right. It would have been after the third record. And you know, we were going from arenas down to theaters, but we still could fill a, you know, a good 2,000 or 3,000, 4,000 seat theater up. And, you know, so it wasn't the work. I don't know. I don't know what the trigger was. I mean, if anybody in this band or establishment knew what the trigger was and we could take it away, we would have done it many times over. We tried. We've had so many conversations privately about this, you know, what we tried to do to help. And it's just unfortunate, you know. We had a sober coach out during the reunion tour, and he said point blank to us that 2% of alcoholics, you know, can't be helped. And he thought he was in that 2%. You know, whatever it was, you know, obviously he met his end, which is just super unfortunate.
Yeah, and I imagine it's got to be remarkably frustrating too, because here's a guy that was so talented and obviously your singer and your front man, and you know he's in trouble and you see it and you're trying and everybody's trying everything, and to be able to not get that light to go on, to be able to bring in professional help and then be able to, and them kind of shrug their shoulders, I imagine that for the rest of the band and yourself included, just kind of feels like a helpless feeling, like you don't know where else to turn. It's got to be remarkably frustrating, I would think.
Absolutely. It's probably the most helpless feeling you can ever have, to watch a friend and a brother like that go through something like that. And you're helping in every way you've been taught to help, you know, by professionals. You hire professionals, you spend the money, You take the time. You give him the opportunity to back out, you know, of everything. We said, look, let's not do this. It's cool. We're cool. We buried the hatchet on all the business crap that was there, all the personal, you know, animosity that was there that comes around with band breakups and stuff that happens in bands. And we were in a really good place when we started that reunion tour, but he was just struggling in such a difficult way that ultimately the decision was that we didn't want him to perish on our watch because we were out on the road. And that's the decision that was made pretty cleanly, you know, about let's let him go home and get better. And we told him to, you know, and it just never happened. I mean, I think he got better than he didn't. And it was a roller coaster ride for him. You saw him, you know, a month or two, you know, on your show before he perished, and he was good.
Yeah, I talked about that before you came on the air. You know, I did not know him well at all. I interviewed him maybe once or twice total. I did not know him. Beyond having worked, you know, done an interview or two, I didn't know him like I know you or other so many other guys to text or call or what have you. But I had a lot of respect for him. And people ask me all the time about when we had him on That Metal Show, because I remember, Joey, that was a tough thing for me, because I remember he wanted to come on. And at that time, and I think people forget this because you just said, you just talked about it, you moved on from him. You had brought Robert Mason in, you know, before Janie passed away. You had made that Rockaholic record, which is a great record. And then Janie was out doing whatever he was doing. And then at that time, I remember you guys were about to release that record. And then Janie was going out and doing some shows with his own band. And both of you had come, both of your camps had come and said, hey, can we do That Metal Show? And I remember taking it to the network and they said, well, we can't do Warrant and the former singer in the same 8-block season. So we'll do Janie this time and we'll do Warrant the next time. And that's what we ended up doing. And Janie came on, and people ask me all the time, like, you know, how was he? You know, and I said the same thing. I mean, I didn't know him well, but he was great with us that day. And that's why it was an even bigger shock that very shortly after that we shot that interview, before it even got to air, he was gone. And I never saw that coming off of the guy that I interviewed that day on TV. Did you have experiences like that with him too? Did you, while you were on the road, was it like you'd have a good show, things seemed to be fine, and then the next day you just didn't know what you were going to get? Was it up and down like that?
Absolutely a roller coaster. I mean, the guy was incredibly talented as a writer and a singer and a front man, and you know, you and very charming as a friend and a brother, and very, very kind to fans. I mean, not a bad word to say about any of that. You know, and then this dark thing would happen, and you just didn't know. It was like just this like Jekyll and Hyde situation where you had this extremely talented, loving, caring guy, and then you know, an hour later it would just be this guy that was looking right through you. And I think, you know, during his stints in rehab that I'm aware of, doctors told him, you know, you need to stop your body, you know, physically, when your body says it's over with, you know. And he took that to heart because he was smart and he listened, but I don't think he could overcome whatever it was that kept him, you know, going back to that bottle. I don't think he could overcome it. No matter who tried to help, his family, his brother and sisters all tried to help, different friends, you know, different wives he had and ex-wives tried to help him. And, you know, it was just something that you didn't know when that switch was going to get clicked on or off.
I want to talk to you a little bit more about him as a musician and being in a band with him from that standpoint, the good times, the positive stuff. So
sure,
we know that he wrote I believe pretty much he's credited as the sole songwriter on almost every Warrant song, if not everyone from that era. How did that decision come about? Was it just that he was bringing in the material, and was that him dictating that, or was it just that that's where the wealth of the songs were coming from, and you guys said, hey, we're just going to roll with this because this guy's bringing the goods? How did it work creatively?
I think, you know, he was the main songwriter. He did write and pen all those tunes, all the lyrics. There was, you know, the things would come in to the studio and ideas would come in. He'd play them on an acoustic guitar. He'd sit down with me or Eric and we'd go through the guitar parts, and then you put your own twist on things and how you play them on a, you know, an electric guitar versus an acoustic guitar, and how things would be arranged. So all that was done as a band, but the general idea would come in sometimes from start to finish, completely written, and then it's just about how are we going to play all the parts and record all the parts, and we would do that with producers and work through all that, and he held that very close to you know, the cuff. I mean, songs like, there's a song on Cherry Pie called Sure Feels Good, where I was at J.B. Frank and Danny Stagg from Kingdom Come. We were jamming together writing one day, and Janie came over, and we had that riff going, and I was working with Danny on it, and he gave Danny and J.B. writing credit. I didn't get writing credit, not a big deal, but to this day, Danny Stagg laughs and said, "Why didn't you get writing credit?" So he held all that stuff really, really tight. I know that Eric got some credit on Cherry Pie because he was there and helped with some of the arrangement. And I know that Bo Hill interjected some of his ideas into a few things here, and he took some writing credit. But back in the day, I mean, it, not to take anything away from him at all, it was him. I mean, he had a craft for writing tunes. No, you know, you know some of the deeper catalog that not a lot of people know. If they're not Warrant fans, that pretty good stuff, you know, especially lyrically content-wise. So that's basically how it worked, you know, for the first three records.
So he came in with the songs, basically. It wasn't like you guys all got in a room. I mean, he would come in and say, this is what I came up with last night. Here's how it goes. And then you guys would just work it out from there.
Right, exactly. That's pretty much what happened.
And it's interesting because Cherry Pie, you guys currently are celebrating that record 30 years after, a little more than 30 years after it came out, but the anniversary of that record by playing it in its entirety. It seems like he had a very love-hate relationship with that song in particular. Obviously, it was a huge song for you guys. It still is. But it seemed like it, you know, it was a bit of a love-hate thing. What were your thoughts on that song, and what did you know about his feelings about it?
Well, when that record was made, it was done, and we were out of the studio and doing things, getting ready to tour and doing a few press things, you know, junkets here and there. And we delivered it to Sony, and then Sony came back, and Donnie Einar had just gotten Aerosmith over to Sony, back from wherever they were. I think they were at Geffen for a while, and then he got them back over to, I don't know if they came back to Columbia or Epic or wherever they went, but it was under the Sony name. And when they did that, they had that Love in an Elevator song out, and Donnie basically called, I don't know if he called our management or if he called Janie direct, and just said, "Hey, this is a great record. I need a big hit. I need a Love in an Elevator." And literally within a day or two, late at night one night, Janie took 15, 20 minutes and scribbled some lyrics on a Domino's pizza box and wrote Cherry Pie. He was listening to the Electric Boys, you know, that song Hips and Lips?
Yeah.
He was listening to a lot of them at the time and wrote that song. And Jerry and I were somewhere and we got a phone call, and I remember him playing the 8-track demo over the phone to me, and he's like, "You got to get back and record this." So we went back to LA, set everything back up, did that song, brought CC DeVille in, and at the time it was fine. Everybody was fired up, you know, we got a big anthem song here, and out of the gate it's going to be the first single, you know, it changes the name of the record, changes the art on the record. John Scarpotti, who did the cover of the record, did a great job. Jeff Klein, who did the video, did a fabulous job. We had a lot of fun doing it. And it got a lot of legs, you know, it was all over MTV. It was all over the radio. So when you're successful like that and everybody's great and you're playing arenas, everything's fine. But the second that it, you know, you get the speed wobble, so to say, and you're not playing the arenas and you're moving down to theaters, you know, you look at something to blame. And a lot of people in the press or other bands and, you know, picked on that song, for whatever reason. And I think he took it pretty hard, you know, but he didn't want to be known as that guy that only wrote that one pop you know, that's an iconic pop song, you know. You would think anybody would go, great, I'll take credit, but it burnt him a little bit because he had such a deeper catalog than that. So I think that's where it bugged him, in my opinion.
What was the record going to be called if you hadn't done Cherry Pie and added it on?
Uncle Tom's Cabin was being thrown around. Quality You Can Taste was being thrown around. Those are the two I remember.
In-N-Out Burger might have came after you on that second title.
You like that, huh? Come on, everybody likes an In-N-Out Burger.
We don't have them on the East Coast, but I got a place in Vegas now, and they open one right up the street, which is really dangerous for me, given that they're open till 2 a.m. I don't need to be eating that late, but it's right there.
Yeah.
And there's that neon.
The East Coast. Yeah.
You see that neon quality you can taste, but I didn't realize that was an add-on. Why was CC DeVille brought in to play the guitar solo on that?
We had such a hard time on the Dirty, Rotten, Filthy, Stinking Rich cycle. You know, usually you make a record, you tour, it's about 18 months long from starting the record to finishing a tour, getting an actual tour, getting, you know, like an arena tour. The last, I think, 6 months of the Dirty Rotten cycle, we were supporting Motley Crue on the Dr. Feelgood tour. So we were so gun-shy about not being able to get another tour, and Poison was getting ready to go out with Flesh and Blood. They were friends of ours, and we thought if we brought Cecil in, he would go, listen, you know, these guys are great. Let's take them out, you know. How's that for a good CC
good
imitation? But and so we brought him in and had some fun recording that and put it together, and we got that tour, and we went out with those guys for a while, and it was fun. You know, it was back in the day, fond memories.
Well, do you think, Joey, and I, of course this is a hypothetical, but do you think that if Janie would have turned it around and gotten healthy, because again, Warrant existed without him a couple times, including with the current lineup for a little bit before he passed away. Do you think that if he could have turned his life around, that there was a scenario where you would have gone back to playing with him? You and I both know how fans are, and you and I both know that as much as I love the band and what you do now, there's a segment of fans that won't accept bands without guys that just aren't around anymore. And you know that that's a thing with not just your band, but some, a lot of bands, despite
right.
how good they are.
Right.
Do you think there's a scenario where if he would have lived and gotten healthy and been able to make a change, that you would have worked with him again?
I think anything would have been possible, you know, and I don't seriously don't want to downplay what Robert Mason does in this band and what a
neither do I. I love Robert.
And what he's done for this band and what he continues to do every night to pay homage to, you know, those songs Janie wrote. You know, absolutely. I mean, he came back after the reunion and hit Eric and said, hey, man, I got it back together. Let's do this again. I want to show everybody what I can do. And there just wasn't any personal responsibility. Like, I'm sorry I screwed it up during the reunion. I really, you know, it was always just a me, I thing at that time. And to be honest, we had been through, you know, rebranding once with Jamie St. James, which was hard, and then the reunion thing happened and failed, and we got Robert in there, and once we had some stability in our band, just like any business, we wanted to march forward and have it be stable and try to grow on what we had at the time, and that's what we've done in the last, you know, 12 years, I think, 12 or 13 years almost with Robert. And so, you know, if Janie would have gotten it together past that, I'm sure, you know, we would have talked about it. I mean, not to belittle Robert by any means, but it is what it is.
Right, of course.
You know, I grew up on Van Halen with Dave Lee Roth. You know, it doesn't belittle the fact that Sammy's a brilliant singer, songwriter, and that the tunes that he did with Van Halen aren't huge and great. You know, but I just didn't, I was bought into the Van Halen with Roth, you know, at that time. It was different after that when they got back together and did reunion stuff. But so I totally get it as a music fan. I understand, you know, but it is what it is. And as a guy in a band that loves my band brothers and the music that we've made together with Janie and without Janie, you know, it would be a very difficult decision if Janie was still around to go back with him and not play with Robert anymore, because I know if we did that, it would be done with Robert. And to be honest with you, I have a great time with Robert, and he's like a brother from another mother to me, and he's the ultimate professional. But certainly, you know, if he was still around, I'm sure there would be talk.
Yeah, I remember clearly, and I've known Robert being a Jersey guy, I've known him for 35 years, and I love him to death, and I think he's fantastic in your band. And I've told him this too, as shitty as this is, the simple truth is, when Janie passed, I think there was a much greater level of acceptance and people looking at him more objectively than when Janie was still alive. Because and that's with any band, when the guy is still alive and out there doing music, the fans are going to continually say, why don't you get that guy back? Sadly, if that guy passes away and that option's not on the table anymore, then they start looking, I think, more fairly and more objectively to the guy that is there. And in the case of Robert, he delivers on every level. He's phenomenal. And I remember at Rocklahoma, it was like 2009, 2010. And I remember distinctly standing backstage in the parking lot with you, and you guys were waiting for Janie to show up. You were headlining one of the days. You didn't know what you were going to get because he had been having problems. And I remember us waving Robert over, and you saying to him, hey, if you know some Warrant songs, can you stand on the side of the stage just in case? Because you didn't know what, Janie, you were going to get that night. I mean, I felt for you because you were kind of like having contingency plans you had to put out there. I'll never forget that.
I'll never forget that either, because I was the only guy that came in a day early to that gig. The day of, because I think Triumph was playing that night, and I really wanted to see Triumph. And you were the first person, like, I literally got out of the car backstage,
yeah,
and you came walking up to me, because it was the weekend after the Las Vegas show where Lane had a really, really rough gig,
yep,
and was hammered. And you just asked me what's going on, and I was honest with you. I said, he's in rehab right now. He's supposed to get out and fly tomorrow and be here. And I saw Robert standing there with his band at the time. Then you can say the name if you want. I don't know if this is a PG show or not.
You can say his name. Okay. He was there playing with a cover tribute band on the side stage called Big Cock. Cock as in rooster. Your heads out.
Right. Yeah, year of the cock, right?
Exactly.
So great marketing behind that.
It is.
But he was there with his band, and I remember just walking up to him and saying, dude, come here for a minute. You know, do you know any songs? So, yeah.
I was right. I forget that, yeah.
And then I did say, you know, I don't know what's going to happen here. Please, you know, he was off our radar because we just didn't, for whatever reason, you know, we didn't think. And when he got on our radar, he came to the sound check the next morning. And Dixon, he saw Dixon before he saw me, and I had asked him, I said, I don't know what's going to happen here. There might be, you know, Lane might be out. I don't know. And I go, come and say hi to the guys tomorrow, because he knew all the guys, because we had played, you know, with Lynch Mob and Warrant prior to that. And he came in, and Dixon saw him first before I even saw him in the morning, and said the same thing I said the night before, you know, or we might need a singer. Are you interested? And he was interested, you know, and you know, the story goes, Lane did a few shows where it was good. And Dixon's like, no, we don't need to try Robert out. Lane's going to be fine. And I, me being the insurance whore of the band, I just said, we need an insurance policy here. Let's just rehearse with him once and see how it goes. And we did. And it sounded fantastic. And lo and behold, a month later, it was over with Janie, and Robert stepped in. So,
well, and if people have not seen Warrant with Robert, it sounds absolutely amazing. He does a phenomenal job. The band sounds incredible. And again, I don't say that just to say it. I say it because I really, really believe it. I love what you guys do. It's the vocals. It's all real. It's all live. It kicks ass. And, you know, I really, really love what you're doing. Hey, real quick, speaking of Jerry, I know he hasn't been playing with the band recently. Is he coming back?
Yes, he will be back. Jerry has toured. He's the only guy in the band Warrant that never took time off. I mean, Eric took some time off away from the band because he... In like 95, 96, because he had some physical issues with some ulcers and things. And Jerry has been the only guy in the band that's just never taken time off. And he's got some things he's trying to figure out with where he's living and his home in Vegas. And is he going to move? And is he going to not move? And he just came to us and he said, hey, man, you know, even though COVID was last year and I had some time off, I'd like to take some time off away and just dial in, you know, what I'm doing on my personal life, and are you guys cool with that? And we said, absolutely. You know, you want your, like anything, you want your brothers to be healthy. I don't want anybody out on the road that's not wanting to be out on the road, as you and I both know, because you travel like a madman. It's not for the weak at heart. You know, you've got to be, you've got to have it together going out on tour and flying and doing 100 plus, you know, flights a year and hotels, and especially in today's world where it's COVID and you've got to sequester yourself and stay safe. And so he's absolutely coming back. He's absolutely healthy. He picked Robbie Crane to step in because Robbie is an old friend of the band from before I was in the band. And you've seen Robbie, you know Robbie well. He's done a wonderful job. He's a brother from another mother as well. And, you know, we're out there doing what we do. It's 110% live, as you said. There's no tapes. There's no Memorex going on.
Love it.
And, you know, Robert, my hat's off to Robert just because he takes a beating from fans that are Janie Lane fans. I get it. Like I said before, I get it. I'm a music fan myself. I get it. But at this point, you know, if you don't like it, don't come to the show, you know? I mean, it is what it is. And he's got balls of steel to stand there every night and absolutely bring it 110%, and he does, and I love him for that. And we miss Janie dearly. There's no kidding there. And it's just unfortunate that, you know, you and I are talking here 10 years later and we're not talking about, you know, something more a little lighter, so to speak.
Yeah.
But we miss him. We miss him dearly. I really, you know, and the band appreciates the time you take out, Eddie, because I know you're just such a huge music fan, and we really appreciate it. And God bless Janie and his family and his daughters. And we'll be out there on the road if somebody wants to come and check it out.
Yeah, man. Well, it's a good way to wrap up. I appreciate the time, Joey, and thank you so much. And again, I say with full sincerity, people listening, you should absolutely go check out Warrant if you have the opportunity to do so. They're out there playing every weekend pretty much somewhere. Just check the band's website, look for a date. Great songs celebrating the great music and songs that Janie wrote and performed on. But again, I tell people all the time too, you guys are all original when Jerry's there, of course, except for Janie, who of course can't be there. I mean, that's an unbelievable ratio by comparison to most bands that are on the road. So it's right. Hard to grumble when you can go and see a totally original band, except for the guy that sadly passed away 10 years ago today. Thanks so much for the time, man. I'll see you out there on the road, I'm sure, again soon. And we'll be hanging and rocking somewhere.
I appreciate it, Eddie. Thanks for the time.
Thanks to Joey Allen. Coming up, another interview for you this week. It is with Jack Blades of Night Ranger, and it's next. Eddie Trunk with you. Jack Blades of Night Ranger joined me on my volume show a couple weeks ago on Sirius XM. He called in to talk about the band's new album, which is out now, called And the Bands Played On. And he also talked about a number of interesting things in this interview, including, will the band Damn Yankees ever play again? That's a question a lot of people tend to ask. And that's a question we don't really know the answer to now, do we? But maybe Jack can share some insights, right? We'll find out, because here's Jack Blades of Night Ranger talking about all that and more on this week's podcast. JB.
Eddie, how are you doing?
I'm good. You guys have been the road dogs. I saw you at M3. I know you're coming up on Monsters on the Mountain in October. You've got... you're on this Rock Island show in Key West I'm doing in January. It's got to feel good to be out there playing in front of people again, huh?
Oh, man, it's the greatest. I mean, night before last, we were at Sturgis. We played with Stone Temple Pilots Monday night, and it was just, it was great. I mean, like, you know, 15,000 people out there just rocking and rolling. And all those, you know, after you play a song that everybody digs, like the motorcycles are in the Buffalo Chip and they start revving their engines. It's freaking mind-boggling how loud it is. It's unbelievable. It's just great.
I've been to Sturgis a couple times. I've done a couple TV shoots there. And for people that have never been there, it's the biggest biker thing, I think, in America. But they don't, to show their appreciation after each song, instead of applauding, they're all idling on their bikes. They rev the bikes. So it is pretty incredible and loud.
It's so freaking loud, man. I mean, like some of them, like we just stood back and stood there We just stood back and stood, you know, it was crazy. It was just unbelievable. And we had to do it four piece because Kerry, our other guitarist, Kerry Kelly, with Night Ranger, messed up his knee and had to have knee surgery. So he was out of action. So Gilby Clark called me that day and he's like, "Hey, I just rode out my bike from LA and I had done some Kings of Chaos things with him before and everything." And I said, "Dude, on stage tonight, you're playing with us." So Gilby came up and played he played, you know, "Don't Tell Me You Love Me," Sister Christian, and Rockin' America with us. It was awesome.
That's deep water to be thrown into. I mean, the guitar, I mean, Kerry, of course, Kerry and Brad now, but back in the day, what Brad and Jeff did on those original recordings, that's deep water for a guitar player to do on short notice. I would think that, I mean, Gilby's a great player and a great guy, but that's deep water to be thrown into.
I know. We were backstage going over parts and everything like that. And he's like, I got it. And he killed it. Absolutely killed it. It was a blast. You know what the thing is? That's what rock and roll is all about. It's the way it should be, man. You got friends that you've known for years. And it's like, if someone's down and out or if someone wants to come up and jam, and that's what we do all the time. We get people up all the time to play with us. So it was just another Night Ranger night. It was awesome.
Yeah, and you can also do that when you're a real live rock band that plays everything live, and you don't have to worry about somebody syncing up to your fake tracks and vocal tracks that you're running. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. It makes it a lot easier that way. That's for sure.
You know, the other thing, we've talked about this before, Jack. I mean, the thing that's so amazing about Night Ranger is that you guys can play in a wide variety of settings and bills and with other bands before or after you. Like, you guys can go out and play like in a very pop leaning bill. You can play in a hard rock thing. You could play even in a more metal leaning thing. Like, you've got the gamut, like the flexibility of who Night Ranger can play with and have guests with them or be on bills with is pretty diverse. Talk about some of the more interesting bills you guys have done over the years. Like, have you ever been on like, after a death metal band or something?
I mean, it just, look, when we first started out in 1982, I mean, they threw us out. We had our first album out and suddenly we're playing in Texas with Black Sabbath. I mean, with, you know, Ian Gillan was singing then and stuff like that. But it was like, we were like, well, this is kind of interesting. This is kind of different for us because we weren't quite as heavy as Sabbath, you know, at the time and stuff like that. But I mean, Eddie, like 3 weeks ago, a month ago, we were up in Kadad at the Rock Fest there, and we played with, Corey Taylor, Phil Anselmo, Phil Anselmo who was, you know, of course, you know who he is and everything like
Pantera.
That. And then Limp Bizkit, Pantera, and then Limp Bizkit was the headliner. And then there's, you know, and here we are at Night Ranger, and the fans freaking loved it. And Corey came out and sang the second verse of "Don't Tell Me You Love Me" with us. So that was great. And then the next night, I mean, we were on with like Hailstorm. I mean, the next big festival we played. So, I mean, yeah. And like I said, it was the night before last, we were on with STP. And then we, of course, all our friends and, you know, Styx and REO and, you know, anything like that. So, yeah, we can kind of, you know, I mean, Night Ranger, we just do our thing, Eddie. We just get out there and we don't like worry about it. I mean, dude, we're not going to out heavy Phil Anselmo. We're not going to, you know, so we don't try to like be the heavy dudes or something
right,
like that.
Right.
We just get up there and play our show, you know, and just kick ass and do it. And we just play, you know, straight ahead American rock and roll. That's what we do. And like with the new album and everything like that, that's all, you know, with ATBPO, and we're up there playing Breakout, our first single, and it's just a big rocking track. And, you know, we don't think about it. We just get up there and do what we do. And I think that's the best thing.
Yeah, no, we're going to talk about the new record here in a second, but one quick thing on Corey. So I remember you, when that was a couple weeks ago, you were hitting me up to get
that
for
was
Corey.
Because
to,
of you. Yeah. Wait a minute. That was because of you. I'm like, we'd met Corey. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump in, but we met.
No, that's
Corey,
okay.
We did, we did that metal show. And
right.
It was like, yeah, it was Brad and Corey and me doing that metal show. And it was like, we all got along great. And Corey's a fan of the band and all that kind of stuff. And then we were playing the show and I texted you and I hit up you and I go, dude, get a hold of Corey, tell him we're playing. Like 20 minutes later, it's like, I got a text. Mr. Blades, it's Corey, it's Corey. What's going on? You know, I say, hey, dude, we're playing the show. Come on. So we went out there and of course he's there and we were hanging out and all that kind of stuff. And I just went up to him. I mean, we were in the dressing rooms all just, you know, shooting the shit and everything like that. And we just, I just went up to him and I said, look, dude, why don't you come out? He says, don't tell me love me. He's always been one of my favorites, man. I love this song. And I said, well, why don't you come up, sing the second verse? And he goes, really? You want it? I said, yeah, you need the lyrics? I can write down. He goes, I don't need the lyrics, bro. I got the lyric. I know the lyrics. So he and his bandmates were standing on the side of the stage, you know, during the show. And, you know, and we came up to Don't Tell Me You Love Me. We sang the first chorus. I turn and look. He's kind of going, you know, with the arms up in the air, you really want me to come out? I just grabbed the microphone and walked right back to him, my mic stand, and just put, I said, come on. And out he came and sang it. It was killer, dude.
Yeah, yeah. That kind of supports my point. Like, when we were doing that metal show, I used to love doing that, like putting the same people on the show, or two different people on the show that people would not expect to be fans of each other or to know each other. And Corey, I know he loves his 80s hard rock. So when we did that, I knew that was really going to work well. And of course it did. And then when you reached out to me about him coming out, I think he was a late addition actually on that bill, or maybe you were, both right. of you were. But when I hit him up, right, I knew exactly. that he's the kind of guy that was just going to be like, jump in on something like that and eat it up. And I was happy to see it all worked out, because the clips I saw online looked like it was a lot of fun.
Hey, man, music should be that way, especially at the stage of the game. You know, we've been around this place for, you know, many, 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 many years. And it's like at this point, it's just got to be fun. Let's just have fun. Let's just get out there and just, you know, just kick ass and have a great time. And who wants to come up on stage? Who wants to sing with it? Who wants to do this? Who wants to do that? That's the great thing. And your philosophy, by the way, is the same philosophy that Bill Graham had when we were in San Francisco. When he'd be booking acts, man, he would book like Montrose and Tower of Power together or something, like, you know what I mean? Just like, what? You know, like, you know, Sly and the Family Stone and like Deep Purple. You know what I mean? He would book like things that people would never dream of, but nobody, it's music, man. It's music. And just like at these festivals when we played, everybody's singing along to Sister Christian and everything. And then everybody's singing along to, you know, Limp Bizkit tunes. So it's pretty, you know, it's exactly what you did is what Bill Graham did in San Francisco.
Let's talk about the new record. And the band's played on is what ATBPO stands for. I listened to the record. I've been playing the record. I think it's awesome that you guys made a record. It's a kick-ass straight up hard rock record. I love it. I love the dual guitar playing, such a big signature of what Night Ranger does. But I got to ask you this. What for you is the driver, and the band, what is the driver to continue to make new music? Because as much as I love it, and I'm sure your hardcore fans do, we both know that there are a lot of bands that just rest on the nostalgia. They've got their hits. They've got their catalog. They know that's what's going to make everybody happy in the crowd, and that's what they hang with. And many don't even bother to make new records. For Night Ranger, you've made some really good new records recently, including the new one. So talk a little bit about that mentality. Is it just you being a songwriter and a musician and the rest of the guys, just you feel that creatively it's just something you have to do despite the fact it's not going to sell 2 million copies and have hits on MTV like back in the day?
You know, I think that people sometimes, I just don't understand that when guys just want to, you know, when bands, you know, sometimes people just don't want to create anymore and stuff like that. Or like, it's a business decision that I remember I read once that Billy Joel said, I'm not going to write any more new music or create any new music or make new records because radio's not going to play it. So the hell with it. And I'm like, cause it is a, you know, when you're creating again and you're throwing it out there again and everything like that, it's a hard road to go down, because you want to make a real great record. You want to make music. You want to create stuff that people really like and everything like that. So it is a process and everything like that. But for us, and for me especially, and for the rest of the guys in the band, this is what I do. You know, I eat, sleep, and drink music. You know what I mean? It's like every minute of the day, there's a freaking song going around in my head. I mean, it's like a blessing and a curse, to tell you the truth. But I mean, I think for me, it's like, you got to keep your brain going. You got to keep everything going and keep it exciting. And for me, the only way to do that is to be creative, is to constantly create, 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 create. You know what I mean? And I think it's the same way with an artist and a painter. I mean, like, you know, Picasso, some of these cats are, you know, like, you know, were painting, you know, from their 30s until their 80s. And, you know what I mean, 90s and stuff like that. I think when you stop creating, that's when you start shriveling up inside, you know. And that's kind of what our whole, you know, our whole, you know, the whole philosophy of the band is in that respect. So we're just going to, you know, we just keep doing it. Keep writing new songs. Keep coming up with ideas. I mean, hey, man, if it doesn't hit right, it's not going to hit the glory days of the Dawn Patrol, Midnight Madness, Seven Wishes, Big Glass. You know what I mean? We're not going to sell like millions and millions and millions of records. But you know what? It doesn't matter to me about that right now. What matters to me is to keep creating and keep coming up with things that are from our heart and soul. And luckily, the last few albums we've done, a lot of people have picked up on the same feelings when we've created, as you know, they've dug the songs that we've come up with. And I think that's what's the reaction with the new ATBPO record too.
Yeah, is it a challenge to get new music into the live set for you guys? Because we all know that touring and the live shows is where the bread is buttered. Back in the day of Dawn Patrol and Midnight Madness, you toured to sell the record. Now the record is almost like get it out there, let people know we're still cooking, and then you go out when you play live. That's where you make your money. That's where the bread is buttered. And I've talked to artists about this before. It's a challenge because you want to play new stuff from recent records, but you're out there at these festivals. You're out there in these shows. You want to make sure the fans keep coming back. Night Ranger's in a great position where you got a half a dozen songs. You got to play every show. So creating the balance, is that a challenge when you continue to add to the catalog, Jack?
Oh man, it's hard. Bro, Eddie, it's like that's the hardest thing. I mean, right now we're playing Breakout in the set. It's just like, it's killer. You know, it's just wonderful. The new track from the ATBPO record. But I mean, there's four or five songs I'd like to play on this record. I'd love to do Hard to Make It Easy. I'd love to do Bring It All Home to Me. I'd love to do Dance. I'd love to do one of the ballads, you know, the one that Kelly sings, you know, The Hardest Road. I mean, but the problem is, you're absolutely right. I mean, you're out there playing, and there's certain songs that you've got to play. You know, Don't Tell Me You Love Me, or Sister Christian, When You Close Your Eyes, Rockin' America. You know, there's a couple more, too. But it's like, I know what it's like in the audience, because I've been there when bands are going, okay, we're going to do a new song off our new record. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, why don't you play one of the ones that we love so much? You know what I mean? It's like, oh, shit, I'll go get a beer now. Right? You know what I mean? It's like,
well, it's hard for something to compete. It's hard for any song, no matter how good it is, to compete, if it's been out 6 months, to compete with something that people have been hearing and living with for 30 or 40 years. I think it just takes time too for it to seep in, because, you know, it's interesting. We recently just had the big 40th anniversary of MTV, and having been a guy growing up with MTV, and I know MTV incredibly important to the early success of Night Ranger. You had that. I mean, that was a game changer. Getting that video on, as you well know, changed everything immediately and could instantly make you successful and recognizable. Now it's such a flooded world of music that I think there's just a much longer gestation period for people to even find out you have new music out and to know it.
I know. It's like, sometimes I see people, oh, you're a Night Ranger. You guys still playing? I mean, I talked to Tommy Shaw once. He saw somebody, you know, like somebody came up to him at the airport. It's like, oh, Sticks, yeah. I remember you guys. You guys still playing? It's like, yeah.
Well, yeah, but you also have people that are completely, totally checked out, that stopped living in 89 and they have no clue. Like, I get those calls all the time. Hey, whatever happened to Sticks? Like, what? Like, you know, so that's a whole different category of people.
Right, exactly. But you know what I mean? You know, to your point, it's just, I don't know, man. It's just, you got to just go out there. And there's a balancing act, because it's also, we as musicians, love playing new things and new creative things. It's like a challenge for our band. We're not like a bunch of dudes that would just sit back and go, oh, dude, do I have to learn the new song now? Do I have to do that now? It's the other way around. It's like, come on, let's play it, let's play it. But yet, you know what I mean? So we want to play all the, you know, a lot of the new tracks and just have fun with them and stuff like that, which we do sometimes. And then what happens, Eddie, is like certain songs really, really feel right with the audience, feel right with everything. The vibe is fun. Everything is good. And so we leave those in the set, you know, and we've done that over the years, you know what I mean? And that's how we've kind of like, we created, but plus which we have so many songs that I love just changing. Each night we play different sets. Each night we play different songs. We're not that band that just sits up there and just plays the same set for the next, like, you know, 6 weeks. I mean, I couldn't, that I just freaking shoot me if I had to do that. So we like, you know, we'll write up a set list before the show, and it's like, we'll throw in this song, we'll throw in that song. And then we're backstage, you know, with our practice amps and working on remembering all the parts and everything like that. I think it's, you know, I think that's what keeps it exciting and different and fun.
Oh, it's all, I mean, I think, I don't remember what M3, I think it was just recently when I was there hosting, and you're the only band I got to actually go out front of house and watch the full set, because you know, with these festivals, you're in a million directions, there's a million bands, but you close the whole thing out. So I was done. So I'm like, great, I'm going to actually go out and watch Night Ranger play the whole thing. And I think it was Why Does Love Have to Change you did that night from Midnight Madness. And I'm like, it's awesome to hear like some of the new stuff, but then the fact that you'll rotate in some deep tracks makes it so great for a hardcore fan like me and the others. But again, also for you, the band, I imagine it's fun to dig into that stuff again and keeps it all fresh.
It's like, that's what keeps it fresh for us. I mean, being able to do that, like to throw in a song like that, or throw in a, you know, a Rumors in the Air, or Penny, I Got Your Number, or something, you know, or just something off of one of those, you know, like a deep track off of an album and it's off one of our records. And it's just, it keeps us like on our toes. So we don't ever sit. And I think that's what Night Ranger never sat back on our laurels and just like, we've never, you know, us, Eddie, we've never like just turned it in. Let's just turn in, you know, we'll just turn in the show, you know, we'll just get up there and like, yeah, play it. Yeah. Thank you very much. Good night. It's like, that's just not in our DNA either with Brad, Kelly, me, or with, you know, Eric or Kerry, you know, and having Eric and Kerry there, you know, those guys know all the old songs, play them, you know, all our, you know, from our catalogs and stuff like that. So when I do say, hey, we're going to do this, that, and that, and that, they just have to brush up on it. And boom, there we are that night. Like, why does love have to change? I mean, how many times have we played that in the last 10 years?
not a lot that I've seen. How are you guys, how are you guys all doing physically? You know, we know that Kelly, you know, had heart surgery, right? I mean, that was announced. And I saw when I went to see you guys at M3, I mean, watching him up there singing and playing like he does behind those drums, you would never know that. And then I look at you still bouncing around and sounding great like it was 40 years ago, and Brad is always in great shape and playing great, and obviously you know, Kerry and Eric, I mean, that's remarkable to me. And again, it's all real, it's all live, it's not like you're mailing it in or faking it. I think it's amazing. I mean, do you attribute that to just taking care of yourself as you get older and also continuing to stay out there and work to keep on your game like that?
I think it's a combination of all those things. I mean, you've got to take care of yourself. And we're like, I've got to sing shows, so I can't stay up. I can't go to the bar and hang out after we play at, you know, 11 o'clock and hang out in a bar till 2, like shouting and screaming and yelling, you're fucking, I love you, brother. You're fucking great. You know, I can't do that. So there's certain things you figure out. You know, because I mean, you can, you know, you go so far, but you just can't physically do that kind of thing. At least I can't. I still can't. You know, I can't do that. And I think Kelly's the same way. I think Brad is. You know, Brad is very much. You know, he's healthy. He's strong. He's bulletproof. You know, I mean, he had shoulder surgery, like tore his rotator cuff, and he was down for like 3 months while we were making this record, which was a pain. But I mean, it was that he came. He's coming back, and he's in great shape. He's stronger now. His arm's just great. His shoulder's just great, and everything like that. And then Kerry with his knee, though, you know, this past like 3 weeks, that you know, he tore something in his knee, and it's like, oh brother, that's a drag. But I mean, we have these 10 days off, and he'll be repaired, and he'll be fine for our show in Vegas and everything like that. So we just gotta do what you gotta do right now. I'm sure the Stones don't party like they did back in 1970 or 1980 or whatever. You know what I mean? And I think you gotta figure that out early on. And if you don't figure it out, you go down the drain, bro. And that's what happens, man. And that's what you see with a lot of artists also, you know? You see them just like circling the drain, bro, because you get, it's like, what do you want to do? You want to keep playing music? Do you want to keep doing this? Because this is my life. This is what I love to do. I mean, music is just everything, you know? And do you want to just keep doing this? Or do you want to drink or smoke or get completely out of your mind or whatever you want to do, you know? You just want to party all the time on the road. It's like, no, you got to make that decision at some point. I mean, there's still shots of tequila in our life, though, Eddie. Don't worry about that.
I know firsthand.
There's plenty of shots. Yeah, you know that for a fact, by the way.
I know that as recently as a month ago or whatever when I saw
you.
But it's after the show. You know, it's maybe just one before and maybe two after. Not excessive.
Yeah,
so everybody.
Yeah, not in excess. Correct.
Exactly right. Hey, so this the new record, I imagine, like a lot of people, a difficult record to make given the COVID situation. Were you doing it during that? Was it one of those deals where everybody's sending tracks around? Were you able to get in the same room? What was the timing on making the record, or was it made before COVID? How did it all go down?
No, it was right in the middle of COVID, and it was a drag. It was a stone drag. I mean, Brad and Kelly and I did a couple of Zoom calls and stuff like that. And that was kind of lame. You know, you're coming up with ideas and you're sitting there. It's just, the last three albums that we've done, you know, like Somewhere in California and High Road and Don't Let Up, we went back to our old way that we used to make records, and that is we all get in a room, we start jamming on songs, like in my studio up in Northern California, we jam on a bunch of songs, and we'd immediately go record them. And it just kept it super, super fresh and urgent and exciting. We'd write lyrics, get everything going, and we just lay the stuff down. But this time, because of the pandemic and everything like that, none of us could get together. I mean, the only people that got together is Kerry came up to my place and for a couple 3 days, and we came up with Coming for You, Monkey, and he added a bunch of, you know, on great stuff, guitars on Hard to Make It Easy and everything like that. And so, but the rest of the time, I sent songs around. I mean, I came up with about, you know, seven or eight tunes, and I started sending them around to everybody. Brad came up with all the music to, you know, he had the music to Breakout, and you know, he sent it to me, and it was like this, you know, it was like a 10-minute opus almost, and everything like that. So we kind of shaped it up and made it into a great song form, and then, you know, I wrote the melody and the of course the lyrics and the chorus and everything like that, and but I'm telling you, everybody, we sent in all our tracks. Everybody would record separately. You know what I mean? And so everybody would send in their tracks. And some songs, Eddie, had 150 frickin' tracks on them. And it's like,
oh, wow.
What? And I mean, you know, like Eric had put on like, you know, 10 or 15 keyboard parts. You know, Kerry put on 15 guitar tracks and 20. You know, I put on a bunch of tracks. Kelly, you know, of course, he played all his drums and everything like and singing and everything like that. And then, so all these tracks were coming in, but nobody had heard what some of the other tracks had already been on there because we weren't completely up to date and everything like that. Well, I never heard that. And so I'm having to like sift through all this stuff with our engineer, Anthony Fox, and we're going through everything. And, you know, this song, this works with this, but this didn't quite work with this and that and that. And I'm getting calls from guys like, dude, where's my part? You know, you pulled my part out. Well, there was another keyboard. Well, dude, what about my part? And then I get, you know, I'd pull that out, and then then Eric would call and go, hey, man, I put all these keyboards. Where's the keyboard? I'm like, well, we it was a pain in the ass, I tell you. It was, but the final, I think what, you know, came out of it everybody agreed. You know what I mean? Everybody, you know, we argue for our parts, and if the argument was good, then the part stayed. You know what I mean? And
right.
if it worked and it felt like right for the song, it did. But, you know, and I think the final outcome is, I think the record, we really pushed to make sure the record sounded like we were all in the room, make sure there were grooves on every song, make sure it had an attitude on every song. And that's what we did. And I think it comes across that way. And I'm really happy that we accomplished that.
You know, one of the signatures of Night Ranger, beyond the vocals and the vocal harmonies and you and Kelly's lead vocals trading off and all that, to me, that I've always loved is the dual harmony guitar stuff. And right up until the new record, on a track like Breakout with Kerry and Brad, that's prominent. And the band that I always equate that to the most is Thin Lizzy, that kind of really pioneered that. Was Thin Lizzy an influence on you guys in that regard at all?
And when we started like in 1980, April of 1980 is when we put the band together. And as you recall, you know, right then, think about it. I mean, Lizzy was like huge, right? And we were huge Thin Lizzy fans. I mean, really, if you think about Night Ranger, okay, well, let's get this. We got a singing bass player. We got two like twin harmony,
yeah,
you know, lead guitars and everything like that. It's kind of, you know, all we did was throw in a keyboard, you know, because Fitz, our keyboard player, was, you know, he's like, hey, I know this guy in Sacramento, Jeff Watson. Why don't you bring your three guys from Rubicon, Brad and Kelly and you, and let's start a rock band. I mean, that's basically the genesis of Night Ranger. But at that point, we were all, you know, we were big Lizzy fans. And, that had a lot of influence on us from the very, very beginning.
Are you guys still in touch with Jeff Watson? Are you on the outs with him? What's his status these days? Do you still know? Do you know what he does now?
I'm not up to date with Jeff. You know, I haven't been up to date with him for a long time. You know, I don't know exactly, you know, if he's, you know, what he's doing, you know. I mean, look, I've been blessed to have played with some great guitar players. I mean, freaking in my lifetime. I mean, Brad Gillis, Jeff Watson. I mean, you know, Kerry Kelly, Joel Hoekstra. Doug Aldrich with the Revolution Saints. And Neil Sean's a good buddy of mine, you know, and Neil and I have done a bunch of stuff together for, you know, on Journey Records and my solo records. I mean, Ted Nugent and Tommy Shaw is a killer, killer guitar player. I don't think Tommy gets enough credit for the kind of, you know, player he is as a guitar player and stuff like that. So I've been blessed that way to be, you know, with some amazing, amazing guitar players.
Okay, so just in wrapping up, you mentioned Revolution Saints. You've done a few records there, Dean Castronovo, yourself, and Doug Aldridge. Do you hope to do another record with that again, or is that pretty much kaput?
No, you never know, you know what I mean? I mean, Dean's now back in Journey.
Back
man.
In Journey, yeah.
I mean, he's playing with Narda. Narda's a real good friend of mine from San Francisco days. I've known Narda since, you know, 1984 also and stuff like that, so it's just really, you know, I'm glad to see Dean back with, you know, back in the fold, you know, because Dean and Neil are such great, you know, players together. I mean, they really feed off of each other when they play together and stuff like that. So I don't know, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with Revolution Saints, but, you know, you never say never. I mean, that's the way
and
I
you,
look at it.
You and Tommy made some records together, just the two of you, the acoustic-based records that were great. Would you like to do that again?
Oh, I'd love to. I mean, always. I'm always up for a Shaw Blades record, man. I mean, Tommy and I sing great. I mean, just great together. I mean, when we first got together back in '89, when I flew to New York, when we put the Damn Yankees together, it was like from the minute we met and started singing together, it was like, you know, I think that first weekend, I think we wrote half the album, half the first Damn Yankees record between Ted and Tommy and me that first weekend there. I mean, yeah, I mean, It's always fun. Tommy, we played a show a couple weeks ago in Ohio and was, you know, Night Ranger and Styx. And Tommy came out and we did High Enough, and it was just so wonderful. You know what I mean? It was just absolutely just great. Tommy's the greatest.
All right. Well, you brought it up, and this is my obligatory question for my audience that I have to ask every time. You just said the word.
Come on, Eddie.
You just said damn Yankees. You know they're always asking. Any update to offer to the fans in any way, shape, or form about ever doing anything with Damn Yankees again?
Okay, I'll say the same thing. You never say never. And I think Tommy said the same thing. And Ted's always up for a Damn Yankees record. I mean, Ted's hilarious, but he's always calling me up saying, I've got the most amazing licks right here. And he starts playing me stuff over the phone. And he's like, all of a sudden, I'm like, he's screaming and yelling. It's like spit is coming through the phone. You know, Ted.
Yes, I do.
I'm like, I have to hold the phone back. He's like, all this spit's coming on my phone. I'm like, whoa, Ted. So never say never, Eddie.
All right, because it's always out there. People always asking. People always wondering. But maybe some unfinished business there with you guys. And, you know, Skinnerd is allegedly ending. So Cardelloni should have some time on his hands soon. I had a caller call up that had a great idea. You know, fans are always full of ideas. They said, why doesn't Night Ranger, Styx, and Ted Nugent do a three-band tour together in sheds? And then at the end, they do a set of Damn Yankees. And I'm like, I can't say that's a crazy idea, but if people go see you and they go see Night Ranger, you do a couple Damn Yankee songs in the set. We should tell people you do Coming right. of Age, and I think you did High Enough too, didn't you?
Yep. Absolutely. I think the fans would get a large rise out of that. I mean, I think that would be a real fun thing, because then we could just end the whole thing with the Damn Yankees, do like five or six Damn Yankees songs right at the end of the show or something like that. I know. That would be killer. Eddie, I'll call my agent. You call yours. Let's get this show going.
I got nothing to do with it. I would just be there as a fan, but anyway.
Call my agent, Eddie.
My people call your people, Jack.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Are you not coming on the cruise with us?
Paul Stanley would throw me overboard if I was on that cruise.
Oh, yeah.
So I will not.
Oh, man. I'd pay to see that.
I'm sure a lot of people would. But no, I will not be on that. I will see you at Monsters on the Mountain in Tennessee in October. I'll see you at Rock Island in Key West in January. And we should tell people to go to nightranger.com, and you can see Night Ranger in Vegas at the Westgate on the 21st of this month. I bought a place in Vegas. I'm just going to miss you for that. I'm getting there a couple days later, but go see Night Ranger in Vegas. You got Summerfest in Milwaukee, Minnesota State Fair, tons of dates. Just go to nightranger.com. Hopefully everything can continue to roll out safely and we can keep having great rock shows. And again, the new Night Ranger album, ATBPO, is out now. It is always great to visit with you, pal. We could talk forever, and I'm sure we will again soon. Best to the guys, and safe travels out there.
Eddie, same to you. Same to you. Looking forward to seeing you again, and thanks for all the years of just, you know, keeping the rock. You're keeping the rock, Eddie. I mean, my hat's off to you, bro. You keep the rock like nobody keeps the rock, so you just keeping the rock, man.
I'll do my best. Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Okay, see you, bro. Bye.
See you, man. Thanks to Jack Blades. Hope you enjoyed that interview. I certainly did. Jack is always fun to visit with. And thanks earlier in the podcast to Joey Allen of Warrant. Thank you for listening. Joel Pollack is the producer of the Eddie Trunk podcast. And new episodes every Thursday. Be sure to subscribe. Be sure to visit me on social media at Eddie Trunk. And I'll see you guys next Thursday. Hopefully see you on the radio on Volume Monday through Friday, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Sirius XM 106. And don't forget the nightly re-airs or on demand anytime you want. Have yourselves a fantastic week, and I'll catch you next Thursday for another all-new episode. Next Thursday, I'm going to bring you an interview with Styx. You're not going to want to miss that. Have a good week, everybody. Thanks for listening.